Welcome back to the Purity Podcast. My name is Chris Archinall, and today I'm excited to be interviewing Taylor Chambers. Taylor is a licensed marriage and family therapist, author, coach, and founder of The Good and the Free. It's an organization dedicated to helping men break free from unwanted pornography use and embrace sexual health, intimacy, and self-leadership. You can find them at wearethegoodandthefree.com. With over a decade of professional training, originally rooted in sex addiction and pornography addiction recovery, Taylor has guided countless men through the hard reset of sobriety, family rebuilding, and relational healing. But his journey didn't stop there. Dissatisfied with the traditional addiction recovery rhetoric, Taylor charted a new course, one grounded not in shame and avoidance, but in sexual health, deep intimacy, mindfulness, and honest self-leadership. Today, he offers online education, coaching, community support, and transformative frameworks to help men, ordinary men, fathers, husbands, singles, to rebuild their relationships and live what he calls the vital life. Beyond his work, Taylor is a husband and father, and a man who has lived through the shame and relapse, walked through it, rebuilt it, and now wants to show others that freedom and goodness are available even before perfection. Today, we'll dive deep into that journey from trauma, shame, addiction, and religion-shaped sexuality to wholeness, authenticity, and hope. Thanks for joining the Purity Podcast. Okay, guys, welcome back to the Purity Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Archinall, and today I am really fired up to have Taylor Chambers on the podcast. As you heard in the intro, he is a licensed marriage and family therapist, author, coach, founder of The Good and the Free. You can find out more about them at wearethegoodandthefree.com. He has way more on his resume than I'll ever have, so I'm super excited to hear from him and all the expertise he has. So, Taylor, thanks for being on, man.
Yeah, hey, I'm fired up to be here as well, so this will be great.
Awesome. Why don't we just start with a little bit about your story and your background, and then you can kind of wherever you want to start, and then what led you into the place you are today.
Yeah, absolutely. I always tell my story a little differently. I feel like there are different elements to emphasize, and kind of one is standing out for me now. But the context is, you know, and I think this will be familiar with a lot of people. I kind of had the typical upbringing, raised up in a Christian home, LDS home specifically, and church was kind of the primary thing. And so what that meant was that my sexual upbringing focused a lot on all the ways that sexuality could go wrong and what not to do with it, in my case specifically. And so, and I wanted to be good. I wanted to be righteous. I wanted to do right by God and other people. And so I knew that this was, or my mindset at that time was, hey, just don't go there, right? There's, you know, it's fraught. Don't, you know, don't bother with that. Well, that worked until about, you know, puberty. And then, then it felt like there was this thing emerging from me that wasn't playing by the same game. It didn't have the same understanding or the same rules. And it's not that I was running around like sowing my wild oats. It was simply feeling attraction and not knowing what to do with that, feeling physical pleasure in my body and not knowing what to do with that. And so, you know, my instincts were to shut it down. You know, I felt tremendous guilt. When I first masturbated, for example, I didn't know what masturbation was or what it was called. I just knew, hey, I think something's off about this. I probably shouldn't do this, you know? And you know, again, early exposure to pornography. For me, when I say early, it was actually much later than what I hear from many people. It was about 15 years old or so. And I had been hounded by my baseball team. And they were just like, somehow got it out of me that I had never seen a naked woman before. And they really made it their goal that season to get me to view porn. And
yeah, they said they were going to tape your eyes open or something like that.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And, you know, they kind of got pretty, you know, verbally aggressive about it. Like, but you know, they got distracted. They didn't care. They were off doing their own thing. So, that didn't actually happen. You know, we went through the baseball season and, you know, no big traumas. You know, I hadn't been exposed to pornography. They didn't They didn't beat me up and force me, you know, nothing like that. So, but man, that curiosity though, I was like, well, what's the big deal, right? And so kind of in my own privacy, you know, felt like I would take these small steps. And so, you know, again, it was about 15 years or so, when I first, kind of stumbled into, seeking out more directly sexual content, you know, swimsuits and then, you know, nude images and things along those lines. And so that's kind of what I meant by this. It felt like this, you know, this thing that awoke in me, you know, this demon that I had to exercise. And so I gave it my best, you know, and there was a period of time where I was doing it on my own. My parents discovered the pornography use. I was so ashamed. They were so disappointed. And so they, but you know, they teamed up and they were trying to be supportive. We dropped into some church resources, like a church-based 12-step group and other things. And a lot of these layers had kind of, it was a lot of double-edged swords, right? I think a lot of good was actually happening in me knowing and learning very early on that sexuality mattered and that it did have risks and that I did want to genuinely manage it appropriately. On my own account, I wanted to be sure to treat others with respect, and gained a lot of cool insights and, you know, really high order values and principles from 12 steps and from other sources. And, you know, had, really off and on success with kind
Yeah.
of resisting. So,
What year was that that your parents intervened or found out about this and jumped
yeah.
in? Do you have an idea?
So I mean, that must have been, I must have been 16, 17 or
Okay.
so.
Okay.
And so I was like going to 12 steps with my mom,
Yep.
as like a, you know, a junior or senior in high school. And,
And you're significantly younger than me, so like what? I'm 55. So what? Like what year? Do you know what year that was? Like, I
Oh,
mean,
that'd have
what I'm
been.
trying to get at is like, it was the smartphone out yet? Because they were showing you
Oh, great
Playboys,
question. Okay.
right? So like, I'm just trying to get a sense of.
Yeah. This would have been 04 plus or minus where I started
Okay.
attending 12 steps. And
Yeah.
so, yeah, this was, I mean, this was dial up internet.
Yep.
So,
Yep.
internet for sure, but it still made that weird sound, you know, when you first fired it up. And, you know, I'm sure looking back, I, you know, who knows how long it took to load, you know, dubious websites back then, but I'm sure it took quite a while. So, I think smartphones were not out. I think, no, that would have been,
2006, 2007. Yeah, I mean that
yeah,
was one
that'd
of
been
the,
a little later, but you know, I remember people had phones, but you know, I was like, who needs a phone, you know? So,
I think
yeah,
people still say that. Who needs a phone? They just have it walk around with a computer in their hand, really.
yeah, exactly.
So
Yeah.
it happens to be a phone.
Yeah. Just so happens that we could call somebody if we ever desperately needed to.
Needed to talk to someone.
Yeah. So yeah, that's kind of the scenario.
Cool.
I went off to, I served a mission, and so kind of in my church upbringing, that was a 2-year stint. And actually, I served 6 months. I was there just with massive depression, and I was actually released from the mission early because of depression specifically. And a lot of the depression, not 100%, but a lot of it was stemming from, I, you know, in hindsight, I'm looking back and I think there were some family dynamics that were contributing. I'm sure there's genetic and other things, but a lot of it was my inner conflict around my own perfectionism. And particularly like the thorn in my side, as Paul says, was pornography and masturbation. And it felt like that should never have shown up. And it should never happen again. And then it would intermittently happen. And, you know, I'm looking at like, I mean, nobody knows the numbers on what is the normal range of like young adult sexual activity, right? I mean, who knows what's normal masturbation and, you know, I think I would probably be just a little below average. Like it wasn't like I was doing a ton, but it meant so much that I was, and it was a really big deal. And so it drove a lot of depression. And it got to a point where, yeah, I was, you know, I was serving a mission, and they're just like, go home, take some care of yourself, get your feet back under you. And so I actually did that. And then I went to college, but it was same time. It was the striving, the perfectionism. And so when I would find tools and therapy approaches, you know, I joined some groups, and, you know, I started getting into the mental health space, just as a client. And I was recruiting a lot of those ideas to reinforce that same problematic inner dynamic. In other words, I'd chosen use all these tools to indeed become perfect. And so it was kind of, you know, just fueling more of the same. Little did I know that, you know, and now I see, like, well, chill out, and maybe this is, you know, stop trying to fix everything. Maybe things get a little easier here. Yeah. So that was kind of a big, that's a lot of the context of how this was going for me.
So you finished college, and then did you decide in college that you wanted to get into counseling and therapy?
Yeah. So the end of college, I was, you know, finalizing, am I going to be social worker, you know, PsyD, LMFT, you know, what, but I knew it was going to be mental health. And so toward the end of college, I went to BYU and did the usual thing, you know, right before leaving BYU, I found a girlfriend, right? And we started dating. And I knew before I, like, jumped into graduate school that I just, you know, I wanted a great summer. So I studied Japanese, and I did an externship teaching English in Japan, hosted through BYU. And, you know, still, that's like a peak experience in my life.
That sounds amazing. Fun. Yeah. Yeah.
So cool. Yeah.
All I could teach him was how to speak Texan. So, I mean, I couldn't even teach him to speak English. So, yeah, it's amazing.
Have you been?
No, English? I haven't. I've traveled, you know, a lot of different places. You know, I've been to Malaysia and Singapore and Australia, and I've never never been to Japan. So it sounds amazing.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, I'd love to visit those places. That sounds great. I heard a couple of people, Americans, speaking Japanese, and one guy was giving, you know, his buddy a hard time because he spoke Japanese with a Texas accent. So, konnichiwa, you know, that kind of thing. But then the Japanese person responded, like, you sound just as ridiculous. Yeah. Both accents are like.
my favorite is when I was in Paris, and I was in a meeting, just kind of the icebreaker is, like, I'm always impressed with everybody at the table, that everyone at the table that I'm sitting at, whatever country I'm in, speaks at least three languages, right? Like, and so I'm like, I'm always impressed by that. And I follow that up by saying, I'm impressed by it because I can only speak two languages. I speak Texan and a little bit of English. And they all laugh. And one of the guys in Paris, he looked across the table at me, he goes, you speak Texan and a little bit American, like not even English. So, like, all right, fair enough.
Yeah, hey, I know English speakers, right?
Yeah. you, my friend, are not an English speaker. All right, carry on. So you do that summer, or it was a summer that you did that?
Summer, yeah. So I was there. You know, we had a 90-day visa, and I spent every day of those 90 days there, just having a great time. Except there was one, you know, this one aspect of, you know, the pornography would show up from time to time. And I was dating this girl long distance, and I was open, transparent about the whole thing, but it was just having its wreckage on the relationship. So I'm staying up. We got this 1 hour window. She's in Seattle, I'm in Japan, and, you know, late at night or her early morning, we can talk for an hour. And all of a sudden, just this, like, my problems and her disappointment, she was really supportive. She wasn't critical or anything, but, you know, just like, it just became like a really dominant theme, and she could tell that I was stuck in a pattern, in a cycle that was sometimes good, but it was still a cycle, you know.
Yeah.
It wasn't really going anywhere. So she ended up calling off the relationship and just like, hey, I'm not really sure that this is going to work, you know? And
while you were in Japan.
Yeah. So I'm there in Japan. She's in Seattle. We have this, you know, this call. And so this was kind of a really key moment. You know, growing up, it was all about being a good son for my parents. That evolved into, you know, being a good Mormon dude for God, you know, for Jesus, and just like, serving a mission and all that. And then, I'm dating this girl, and I'm like, okay, I know how to do this. I'm supposed to be the good boyfriend to this cool girl. And then all of a sudden I find myself, and I can still picture the room. We stayed with host family, so it was this old Japanese room with tatami mats, and me and my roommate, who had also come from BYU there, we had the sliding door divided things, and I'm sitting on my bedroll in Kishiwada, Japan, crying, heartbroken. This girl was really special and it wasn't going to work, and it felt appropriate that it wasn't going to work. Like, this was a good move for her, kind of a recognition. And so, it felt like it was because of porn. And again, in hindsight, I might modify that a little bit. It might be more how I was relating to myself, to pornography, to everything around it. But, but porn was a key player in this. And I felt really alone in a kind of keen way where I was like, I'm in a foreign country. I had no one around me that I could really talk to. It was complicated. This was not subject matter for friends and family, the pornography side of it. I mean, I had talked with some about it, but I just felt really alone. So it was basically like me on this island with God. It was just, kind of the two of us for this moment. And, I prayed, and I was just like, man, what do I do with this pornography thing? I had zero confidence that I could conquer it. And a lot of my motivation wasn't there. Like, the girl wasn't there. My parents weren't there. It was feasible that it was like, hey, if I want this, I could do it, right? So it was this kind of like moment of like, do I keep doing it? And that felt like a pretty easy answer. Like, yeah, I keep going at this. And then it kind of had some depth to it in terms of like, but why now? Like, what it's not so I can save this relationship. And so the motivation really shifted. It became much more intrinsic at that time. It became less about performing, and it became more about, I just want to know that I'm the kind of guy that is fighting this. And even when you remove hope, because I didn't have any at that time, it was like, this may be stuck for the rest of my life. But if it's stuck, I want it stuck with me trying to do something instead of stuck having given up, if that makes sense. And so that made a big difference for me. And that internal shift meant that I could start really doing some of the self-examination that was necessary. And I started tapping into resources and kind of throwing myself into those resources in a really constructive way.
Yeah,
And
cool.
there's plenty more chapters after this story. I wouldn't say this is the end by any means, but I think that that's kind of a crucial piece that I think might be important for people and might resonate with a lot of people. And kind of really finding out this is for my own benefit, and there's a way I want to relate to my sexuality that's different than me kind of trying and then kind of feeling frustrated that it isn't working out, but chalking it up to that's the best I can do. I wanted it different, and so that's where this turning point came for me.
So you finish that, you go to Abilene for your a master's program. And what was the plan to go there for, like sexual addiction counseling, or what was your thought when you went to Abilene?
Yeah, at that stage, I'd been more interested because I had done some work and I had gained some ground with my depression from that earlier period. So I thought, probably depression, or maybe I was really interested in relationships. My parents had gotten a divorce while I was in college, and so kind of knowing like, hey, I want to figure out how relationships work so I don't repeat that, kind of scenario. And so I was like, maybe mental health as it impacts couples or something. That was my focus. So and that gradually over the 2 years of graduate studies did kind of shift. Because during that 2 year period, that's when the cycle shifted. That's when I kicked off extended sobriety, and that's when I was like, oh man, this is different. And maybe as I'm learning things, I could help other people. And so, at the backside of graduate school, I graduated, and then my first gig, I had worked with someone and was jumping into their group practice specifically for pornography addiction, betrayal trauma, and things along those lines.
At some point, you had a change where this idea of traditional addiction recovery, this approach that you had originally was maybe different than what you wanted, and that maybe turned into what you built out of now, what you call the good and the free. What was that shift or that change that took place?
Yeah, okay. So this is kind of another major arc to the story. So I did it right in the sense I kicked off, a 5-year sobriety streak using addiction-based therapy approaches, group therapy. This was something that I applied to myself, and that I was being trained in when I got to that point early in my career. And I was in it. I loved it, and I still do. A lot of this, a lot of it holds. A lot of it is still just incredibly valuable, and is still active work that I do with my clients today. But I was still doing it. I was still doing the thing, right? I was still using the addiction model and all the behavioral recommendations. My whole framing around sexuality was still the perfectionism that was a big core issue for me. But I was winning at it. I was playing the old game, but I was winning, right? So I got that sobriety, and then life got complicated, and there was kind of this, gradual breakdown of a lot of different things, a lot of things in my life, for better and for worse. But at that time, all of it for the worse is how it felt. Just things piled on top of each other, and so really strained my ability to continue winning at the game. So what I mean by that is I ended up marrying that girl that I dated while I was in Japan. We reconnected. She started to see that something had shifted, and as we continued dating, the cycle changed, and she saw evidence of that. And so we ended up getting married, which was great. And then 5+ years later, we're having our first kid. She had gotten really sick during that pregnancy. That was a big stressor. My dad passed away unexpectedly. That was a big thing. I was in a really crappy job. It was just really difficult for a lot of reasons. But I just didn't feel aligned with that work. It felt troubling to me. And I mean, I could go on about that, but it was out of alignment. And then I lost the job, and which was kind of a relief, but not really, because then, we're about to have this baby, and then the baby comes, and I've got this newborn, financial stress, grieving, and then I'm not at my best, so I'm bringing more and more intensity into the relationship, more and more conflict, and like as the marriage starts to, I'll say, deteriorate. I mean, we're still happily married to this day, but it took some damage during the season, and so there was a lot of resist, don't fall to porn, but there was this eventual, I kind of picture the dam in New Orleans, or
The levee,
it just kind of breaks, and blood. I have this loss of sobriety. This part of me once again shows up, kicks butt, and it's just like, oh man, I lost. And my ego, my sense of self, my sense of worthiness before God, all kinds of things, was just all based on like, hey, I had a good thing going, and now I don't get to say 5 years sober anymore, right? And what does that mean about me? And what do I do with this? And so, I tried to pick it back up, but long story long, I guess, I start to look at some of the other therapy models that I had looked at, some of the ways that I had actually been successful with things like the depression, which was actually very different than this, the approach that I was taking. And I started to look at how I was misusing a lot of the addiction stuff, and how easy it is to misuse, because it can be very behavioral, and it can be very outcome focused, and it can feel like identity is
Checklist.
tied to performance. It's all of your stuff. Yeah, checklist, exactly. So I get back on the wagon, so to speak, but there's this kind of niggling thing of like, oh, but is this the game to be played? Am I on the right wagon, I guess you could say.
It almost feels like you're kind of like, not to put these words in your mouth, but I'm going to use the name of your business now, is that those things of doing the checklist and getting the milestones and all those things are good, right? It's not bad. It's just if that's all there is to it, then it's just you feel like you're on this hamster wheel and there's no finish line. Or maybe you were looking for a finish line, but now you're saying there's something more. There's a place that where you can be good and free, right? Like you don't have to be on this treadmill anymore. You don't have to continue doing the push-ups and, checking all the checklists and doing all, I mean, you still do those things, but it's for a different purpose. It's not because you want to stay sober. It's because that's who you've become, right? Like that's the person you've become. Anyway, carry on.
Yeah, no, I think that's very well put. Yeah, I still maintain discipline. I still do, goals. I still aim for sexual purity, I guess you could, of course, right? Those are still, but it's now, it's like there's a bigger story. Like that had kind of been my whole thing, like, hey, conquer this demon, and then, then I get a redemption story. And that's kind of that's the main plot line of my life. And now at this stage, my life is a lot more multi-layered and complex, not just because like I do a lot of other things, but meaning and identity is integrated with a lot of different things. And the way I relate to my sexuality now is I recognized how much fear and repression I had used both unsuccessfully and also successfully, right? It did the job I wanted it to do.
Right.
But not always. And that was kind of the thing. And I was like, well,
Right.
okay, so do I need to start relating to this aspect of myself differently? So
Yeah.
yeah, that kind of really shook things up and
Yeah.
has really influenced me now in paying attention to not am I getting the job done or am I winning the game, but am I living a vital life? Am I honoring and enjoying my sexuality?
Yeah.
Can I find ease and peace in my own psyche? Am I relating to life like it's a thing I've got to piece together, or am I letting it be the bigger force? I'm just a little leaf floating on the stream, right? Like I no longer have the illusion that like I'm creating something that from scratch and that life gets to move out of my way for me. I'm like, man, I don't know. Like life is bigger than me, right? So the different things that have really impacted my perspective.
That's awesome. I've got a lot of questions for you, so maybe we can do these kind of rapid fire.
Let's do it. Yeah.
So from your approach and how you do things, you talk about moving from sexual repression or avoidance towards sexual health and wholeness. How do you define that sexual wholeness? What does that look like?
Yeah, so this is kind of the shift of, in my story, I had the goal of sobriety. And as long as I wasn't doing bad stuff, that was the end game. Sexual wholeness, fearless sexuality is kind of the thing I aim for here now. What I mean by that is three elements around intention, integrity, and intimacy. The intention is, this idea of I want it to be the way that I want it to be, more or less, right? I mean, like I said, life still gets to be life. My sexuality still has an influence on me, not just me that way. But what I mean is, I'm not reckless. I'm not compulsive. I'm not completely shut down. I have some intentions with, hey, I'm never going to get rid of my sexuality. So what do I do with it? Whereas previously, I was kind of like, hey, get rid of that sexuality, but then keep this other sexuality that feels very separate. That's, for my wife, and that gets to be its own thing. So now I have a relationship with my sexuality, and I want some intention with how I relate to it. The integrity piece is that it aligns with my values, as as we would understand it, but also that I've integrated it. Integrity in the sense of like it is now a functioning part of the overall system. It's not pushed to the side. So again, it's reinforcing I am a sexual being, and what do I do with my sexual energy in this world? And how can I bring it into the world in a way that creates more goodness, more joy and pleasure for me, more joy and connection in relationships, and maybe even has a positive influence out in the world, not through sexual contact, but like, I mean, even me, like, hopefully bringing. Maybe a vision of sexual liberation for others, that can be kind of using my sexuality for goodness. And then this intimacy thing, right? Of course, like there's such richness in relationship with other people, and specifically, nothing is quite the same as a committed relationship, long-term romance, sexual component, emotional component. That intimacy is so compelling. And so I'm trying to build that rather than avoid bad behavior. And so, yeah, hopefully that gives a vision of, that's why the repression stuff gets in the way, because I need to not be afraid. I need to not shut it down if I'm going to have a dialogue with my sexuality and then team up with my sexuality to go about creating things with it. And so it's a very different paradigm.
It's interesting. So something you kind of said there about fixing this part of me, right? Like this sexual, having this sexual wholeness, and like it's more than just stopping the behavior or whatever. And one of the things that I talk to guys a lot about is, well, as a lot of people say, sexual addiction is not. It's a bad solution, right? Like it's just something that we've used to solve our problems. And like there's so much that leads to that. And so if we're just trying to stop our sexual addiction and not dealing with pride, not dealing with anger, not dealing with different types of depression or family of origin, and not dealing with our inner soul and our inner heart. I mean, like there's so that's all of those things are the things that really lead to your sexual acting out in the first place. And so it's really that sexual wholeness incorporates all of those things, and looking at the whole aspect of who we are and bringing all of those things into alignment is what I kind of hear you saying.
Exactly. There's this overall ecosystem of our lives, and we want everything to be thriving, right? Absolutely.
What are some common psychological or emotional patterns you see underlying the porn addiction, especially like in maybe high achieving men?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that perfectionism that I described is a really key part of that. There is this, the other one that I would highlight was in my story as well, which is there's this sense of, sometimes I'll talk with clients of like, why do you want to change pornography, right? Not everyone does. Some people are out seeking out pornography, right? And yet you're saying like, no, I want this out of my life. Why is that? And I find that a lot of people, it's such a given that the reasons, the why behind it is not always actually very clear. And a lot of times it's like, well, because it's bad, because the industry and trafficking, and obviously it's damaging in my relationship and stuff like that. But and those are valid, but a lot of times there's this sense of like, what if it didn't matter? What if you could? Would you still choose it? And I think for a lot of people, they would. And that's neither right nor wrong, I would say. There's this unspoken ambivalence in the midst of a spoken commitment. It's like, yes, I know I'm supposed to, therefore I'm on the project of doing it. And I think when we pause and say like, what am I wanting to? Like, am I ready to? Am I changing this dynamic, actively? Am I making the sacrifices to do so? A lot of our motivations get really mixed and are just like out of obligation. And those are not often strong enough motivators to actually undergo life transformation, right?
Well, and I would say, and I know we've talked before the recording that you deal with men of faith, you deal with men of, people that are atheists and others that maybe aren't have no
That's right.
faith background. I would say for a Christ follower, the motivation is your body's a temple, right? And so there's a lot of this, there is a significant amount of guilt, I think, that goes into that. And we've tried to pray it away, and we've tried to, will it away, and just done all of the right things. So either God isn't big enough to change me, or he's not listening and he doesn't care to change me. But it really, a lot of it has to do with how we go about treating it. And so one of the questions I had is like around that is, what does the role of community and this honest dialogue and other, support from other men, how does that play out versus this isolation and secrecy, that many men deal with?
Yeah, well, as you might imagine, I'm a big fan of Community.
Yeah.
I think everyone is, right? We all kind of know how powerful this one can be.
But
The
let me
community.
push back there just a little bit, because I think this is where we do, because like once you get a taste of it, you're like, oh, this is what it's about. And I think it naturally comes when you get into a community of men that you really relate to. Like when I went to my first Castamonia meeting, I won't tell you what kind of cars and vans and stuff I thought was going to be outside this thing. I just thought I was walking into a, and I don't joke about that anymore, because we do have that situation with men, that have dealt with different, serious issues. But I walk in and I realize these guys are just like me. And it instantly became like this church, the best church I'd ever been a part of. And I think it was because of this like-mindedness, right? And so then community became important. But I do think that like a lot of guys that have this, you talk about community, it's like, no, I've been on the men's retreat. Like I've been on the one where everybody's surface level and talking about, I wish I could raise my kids better, or just like this surface level stuff about wish I had a better job, or wish I had, these things. When you get into a community like you're talking about, it's like badges come off, or whatever you want to call it. Like all the titles come off. Nobody cares what your blue collar, white collar, you're digging ditches, driving 18 wheelers, or running a company, right? Like it's all, you're all there for the same purpose. So that's the only, that do you experience that with guys initially that have a little pushback on this idea of
Oh,
community?
yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is the thing that we, I think, need most and fear most. I would say intimacy is the thing we long for and fear most.
Yes. Yeah.
And the community is kind of a version of it, an aspect of that intimacy of like being attuned and aligned and close to other human beings. It's what matters more than anything, but it's
Yes.
also, that's why it's so high stakes, it feels. So
Yeah.
there
Yeah.
is certainly a lot of resistance and reluctance to enter into community. And I think that part of that is because I think many of us might justify staying out of it because it is what you described of like either these are people that are being fake. Or I don't think they're being fake. I think they're just legitimately better than me, right?
Yeah.
And communities like that, I would say, are more of like that's more of a parade than a community,
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
it's hard because that's what we see and that's what
Yeah.
we do. And I don't know.
That's a fantasy football league, man. Like that's all that is.
And so, so we have this pressure then to perform. Again, it reinforces these things of like, I am supposed to, dominate my sexuality, dominate finances. I'm supposed to crush it as a Christian dad and, husband. I should have a whatever, a killer car, killer everything, right? So that's the parade. The community that you touched on is when we actually start to see that there are indeed differences and similarities, and it's the similarities that are so key for us.
Yeah.
And the similarities with different people, I think, that's I love that stuff. That's why I love story, right? Because we can drop into the viewpoints of so many different people, and they're so different than us, and yet they're the exact same. I just love that, right? And so when we're getting, we're getting toward the nucleus of humanity, when we're touching on the reality that it's complex, that we all have victories and we have flaws, and most of us are making it up as we go. I remember working with somebody who would always say, like, nobody knows what they're talking about. I don't know what I'm talking about. Nobody knows what they're talking about. And I was like, oh. Thank you. Thanks. I don't know what I'm talking about. I just figured I was the only one, right? So we're all kind of bluffing our way through life, and community is where we realize that we're participating in life. We're not in the parade, but we're contributing. For me, I actually reorganized my group and community approach here recently. This was a pillar because I was actually reading a parenting book about how parenting occurs in indigenous communities. And it's very different in many ways. Toddlers are still toddlers, right? But it was interesting. And I was like, I was reading that. And I was actually just feeling this longing for that kind of community. Like, oh, what would it be like if I just grew up in a nomadic hunter-gatherer culture? That would have been great. Of course, that's the easy thing to say when I'm reading a book in my air-conditioned home. But there was something that was like meaningful contribution is a part of community. And so I kind of built my groups around, I'm a side character in my groups, not the expert giving and disseminating advice. And that felt really important. So I guess for people who are, I don't know, questioning this community and what role does it play in their story, I would say, does that have to look like joining a porn group or a 12-step group? Not necessarily, but I would look for, are people able to be real both about the good and the bad, right? They're not always beating themselves up. They're not always pretending. Can we be real about, like, I've got strengths, I've got shortcomings. Yeah, of course we do, And I would also look for, I mean, sometimes in those spaces, like a lot of porn groups are going to be advice-based, quick Q&A type groups. That can actually be fine, but you need somewhere in life where you feel like you're making an impact. And so having that sense of contribution can be really, really key. I try to integrate those into my own groups, but you might find those in separate spaces. So community, huge. It's scary for all of us. So just take one step, but you've got to move into it. Yeah, I don't think there's any way through without community into spiritual development, into personal development, and so on.
Yeah, my friend Mark Dennison. I just name dropped him. I'm just kidding. I mean, a lot of guys listen know Mark Dennison, but anyway, he's a friend of mine, and he one of the things he says is the best group is the one you'll go to, right? Like that's the best group. The best group for you is the one you'll go to, and I kind of love this C.S. Lewis quote where he talks about friendship, and it says that he says that it's born at the moment when one person says to another, "What? You too? I thought I was the only one."
Oh, wow.
And it's such a great quote because it's you said that just a second ago, right? You said, "I thought I was the only one." And I say so many times, and I say it again to the men listening to this podcast, like, guys, it doesn't matter who you are, what you become, whatever you've done, I've either done it, thought about doing it, or given enough time and resources would have done it. Right? Like there is no end to, for me, what this sexual addiction had done to me. And so for me to isolate and for me to hold this in secrecy, as Dr. Phil would say, like, how's that working for you? It didn't work for me forever, right? So like the fact that I was able to get into these groups and see men that were dealing with the same stuff and relate to them and connect with them, I mean, it was life-changing. It was life-giving and just a huge, huge part of it. So I love that you have those groups. And I love that it sounds like you really work from the therapy side, which is probably the looking back, and then the coaching side, which is looking forward, and having those groups together there is just a powerful thing. So I want to land the plane here a little bit, but I do have a couple more questions. What's the best way for somebody to get connected with you? And like, is there a first step with getting connected to you? What's the ideal way to get with you?
Yeah, absolutely. I would recommend going to wearethegoodandthefree.com. I'm sorry, it'll take about 3 minutes to type that in. It's a very long URL.
You only have to do it once, though, because
That's right.
the Google machine will remember it from then on.
Yeah, it'll know. Wearethegoodandthefree.com, and then I would say my recommendation would be there's a button that says free workshop. I would jump right in there. In that workshop, I talked specifically about mindfulness, which we talked about without talking about today in our interview. It's a different perspective, a different way of understanding and relating to, and even working through sexual challenges, pornographies and other things. So, and like I said, I integrate this with some classic addiction stuff as well. But I really like to explore some of these, I'll say, newer perspectives. And so I'm hoping that it's a resource that's there for free that can be really expansive for people. And then that'll put you on my email list, and you'll get some emails where I love writing. And so, I love just to share kind of whatever quirky ideas, tools, whatever's been meaningful to
Love
me.
it.
I'll share that on a several times a month you'll get emails that
That's awesome.
for
That's
that.
awesome. Last two questions. One that I always like to ask is, did I miss any question that you like to answer? Is there something that you like to talk about that I didn't ask you a question about?
Great question. I mean, we didn't get into existential philosophy, but that might be an entirely different podcast
That might be a different podcast.
or
Bro, you
a
might need
stage of
somebody
history
smarter than me to have
kind
that conversation
of
with. Unless
thing.
you don't mind me just nodding my head throughout.
Just
Like,
saying, sure. Yeah.
sure. Ah, good.
No,
Yeah.
what I would say is like the thing that we got into that I really love to emphasize, I do think we covered, and it's that way of relating to your sexuality and befriending your sexuality, just knowing that that's possible, even though the track record is terrible. It's always caused problems. It maybe caused your divorce, maybe it got you thrown in jail. I mean, sexuality can do a lot of terrible things. So the idea of befriending it can feel very foreign and very, very odd. But I think that sexuality does its worst damage when we are trying to eliminate it, when we're trying to contain it. I mean, an animal is most dangerous when you've cornered it. And so when you give it an enclosure, it still has boundaries. But when you give it an enclosure where it has the things that it can thrive, it can be an additive experience in your life. And so, yeah, just really supporting that idea. And if you haven't figured that out yet, that's okay. Keep seeking out resources. That workshop might be a follow-up space to go there, but there are plenty of other spaces, other people that are sharing similar ideas that I think are really important to follow through with.
That's great, man. Okay, last question. I ask everybody that I interview this question, and it has nothing to do with recovery. I love to tell stories. I'm a writer as well. I love to write. I love to tell stories. If you get me in a room with a bunch of people, I've got 12 stories I could go to that would be funny, endearing, make you laugh, make you cry, whatever. What's one of your favorite stories? If you have everybody's attention and it's appropriate, like that, it doesn't have to be funny. It doesn't have to, it could be anything. And by the way, I'm in sales, so I don't mind silence for a while and, we
Okay.
can edit that out. But, what's a go-to story that you have whether your wife or friends say, Taylor, tell that one.
Okay, story. This is almost one comes to mind, but it's almost not my story. You know what? I'll take advantage. So it's a bit
Yeah.
about my mom.
Yeah.
She'll forgive me. So,
Yeah. Let's go.
growing up, she went on a mission just like I did when she was younger. To Japan. So my dad went on a mission to Japan. She went on a mission to Japan. When they're back in the US, people are like, hey, you guys both went, you should meet each other. And so that's kind of how they got connected.
Okay.
So, like I said, my dad passed away a dozen years ago now. And so, my mom's been, doing her own thing for quite some time. But this last year, somebody that she had met there got in touch with her. She was there, she met him, and he fell in love with her. It's this like beautiful American cowgirl in Japan, and like how could he
What's
not?
not to love? Yeah.
Yeah, so he falls in love with her, and then they go on and they lead separate lives, but they both find themselves available at this stage. And so over 40 years later, he reaches out to her. And it took some doing. I mean, like there was, they weren't Facebook friends, 40 years ago, because that wasn't a thing. So he had to kind of find out, how he could get in touch with her and stuff like that. And so they've just started a relationship, and they've been dating, and it's just been really quite cool to see that come alive. And I think the reason that this matters to me, I mean, at one level, it's my mom. I care so much about her. Somebody is just loving on her and
Yeah.
has like and has kind of had her in mind and care in a caring way for just so long, and just made a
Yeah.
really bold move. And I think that's beautiful. I don't know. I mean, she was Where are they going to live? What language are they going to speak? You know, who knows?
Right.
A lot of things.
Yeah.
Maybe this relationship doesn't progress into a bigger thing. But even if this was just kind of a cool year for them, if it stays just kind of a simple friendship forever, if it
Yeah.
advances in the marriage, who cares? But like, just so cool that she's, you know, got this happiness
Yeah.
after being on her own for quite a long time.
Yeah.
The other thing is, it is just this, you know, I talked like life is bigger than us. It has its own path, and nobody chooses the life that they end up leading. We make choices in it. We construct some of it. We certainly have great influence, but I just love things like this that remind me of like how wild and untamable life is. It is so much like our sexuality. It's wild and untamable. And yet, I think if we're really doing our part, we can find goodness in it. And we can find goodness in our sexuality much the same way. And we can kind of bring it to these spaces. So, anyway, just like, you know, wild things in life and
Yeah, what a
so,
great story.
yeah.
It says a lot about your mom that A, you would want to tell that story about her, and then B, that a guy who met her when they were both around 19, 20 years old, something like that,
Yeah, that's
remembered
right.
her, remembered her name, and 40 years later was able to track her down. Like, that is super cool.
Yeah.
That is super cool.
Yeah.
She made quite an impression.
He was not the first. I think she was quite
She
heartthrob, maybe even
was like,
heartbreaking.
which one are you? Which one were you
Yeah,
in line? Were you number 36 in line, or which one were
that's
you?
right. Yeah. She was
There
quite the hot commodity,
you go.
she really is a great woman. But
That's
it's been
fantastic.
just so fun to see. I don't know, something so unexpected. She traveled out and visited him there, and just learned about him. He's got some cool samurai ancestry, and so
Wow,
she's
that's
trying on
cool.
this like ancient, you know, medieval armor, and he's
Yeah.
just wandering around Yokohama and other things. So it's cool, and it's just cool that life gets to do that to us sometimes, you know.
Yeah, super cool. Man, thank you so much for jumping on and doing this. I really appreciate the time. I'm super excited about your just what you're doing and the way you're reaching men and helping men. And really, like I said, families as a result of that. Like, it's just so cool that you would take your experience and the things that you've learned through your study and realize, hey, this doesn't have to be a cookie cutter approach. It can be something that I've learned through my way of gaining sobriety, but wanting more, and then taking that and molding it into something that really works for a lot of men. So, really exciting. I really appreciate you jumping on the podcast today, and I hope you'll get some men that will reach out to you as a result of our time together. So thanks so much for being on.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks so much, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
All right, man. Thanks. As we wrap today's conversation, I want to thank Taylor for his honesty, his clarity, and his willingness to name the things that so many men feel but rarely say out loud. Hey, next time on the Purity Podcast, we're going to step directly into the wreckage of betrayal and the hard work of rebuilding trust. I'll be joined by Rick Reynolds, licensed clinical social worker and founder of AffairRecovery.com. Fantastic ministry. Rick brings both professional depth and lived experience to this conversation. We'll talk about infidelity, disclosure, accountability, and what real recovery looks like for both the betrayer and the betrayed, without shortcuts and without pretending that pain isn't real. You don't want to miss this. Thanks for listening to the Purity Podcast. If this episode was helpful, please consider subscribing, sharing it with someone who's fighting the battle for sexual purity, or leave a review so others can find us. Until next time, stay honest, stay humble, and keep pursuing the kind of freedom that doesn't require you to disappear to survive. And remember, as you go along this journey of recovery, you are not walking alone.